Okay, so this is a discussion between Paracon, dialogue between Paracon and anarchism. I'm Christine Karatnitsky. I'm not going to sit here. I'm just going to introduce these folks, and then I'll moderate the discussion or questions later on. If folks want to move forward, that might help you hear better, because I don't think this is mic'd. We're just going to project. And I'll read you the description from the program, just so you know what we're talking about. It says, could a new society be set up after capitalism, one which relies neither on the market nor on the state, a society based on directly democratic workplace and community councils? One such program has been called Paracon, from participatory economics, as developed by Michael Alpert, Robin Hanel, and others. These ideas have been critiqued by concepts from the tradition of revolutionary anarchist communism. A dialogue will be held, and here we are, by representatives of each point of view with discussion with attendees. On the left is Chris Spanos. He is on the staff, and he's an editor at ZNet, and he has just completed a book that is coming out next month. It's not here now. But it will be available through AK Press. It's called Real Utopia, Participatory Society for the 21st Century. On my right is Wayne Price. He is a longtime militant in labor, human rights, and anti-war struggles. And he's a member of NEFAC, which is the Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communists, as am I. And he writes for Anarchismo, and he has a book for sale upstairs called The Abolition of the State, Anarchist and Marxist Perspectives. Chris is going to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes. Wayne is going to talk for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then we'll have a discussion. And this will be over about 5:15 or 5:20 so that we can get ready for the next panel. Okay? So thanks to you both.
Thanks, Christine. And I'd like to thank Wayne for organizing this panel. Essentially, I agreed to do it, and I took the bus 5 hours today to be here just to do this. And part of the reason is because very honored to have a dialogue about Paracon and anarchism, because I believe anarchism is one of the ideal forms of social organization that we should strive for, and so. It's an opportunity to kind of present my own thinking and some emerging thinking that's happening around these ideas. The description that I got of the panel, I had a slightly more detailed one with some questions posed about Paracon, which I'll try to answer along the way. And some of those questions were, what should anarchists think about Paracon? Is Paracon consistent with anarchism, or is it another version of a market economy? And is the road to Paracon reformist or revolutionary? So I'll begin with the first, and it's you know, what should anarchists think about Paracon? And when I think about it, I'm actually quite daunted by the question, and that's because in my mind there are many strains of anarchism, and for me to try to address every conceivable issue that you know one variant of anarchism might have with Paracon, or what I imagine they might have, would be impossible here. So without sidestepping the question, I do want to respond to it, but at the same time, I want to do so generally, and at the same time make connections within which Paracon, I believe, is situated within the anarchist tradition. And so to do that, I want to, you know, step back and say that for me, anarchism in its purest form is concerned with power relations, and that traditionally the concern has been with economy, God, and state. And today, now there are many variants, and this has been ongoing and developing for a long time. But examination, resistance, and uncompromising condemnation of oppression. And so for me, this is the tradition in which pericon and more generally the vision of a participatory society evolves from. That tradition, which looks at the totality of oppressions and seeks to provide alternatives, alternative values, alternative institutions that will facilitate emancipation in these defining spheres of social life. The other tradition of anarchism that I believe pericon stems from is the tradition which embraces vision. Within anarchism, there's a tradition which rejects vision, and there's a tradition which embraces vision. I believe that it's wrong to reject vision. And so I embrace it, I advocate it, I work towards, you know, I work with others who advocate it and try to develop it and organize around it. And for me, the reasons why I think rejecting vision is wrong is, well, first let me present the reasons why some people may reject vision. And some of the arguments might be that vision is authoritarian. It's vanguardist. And there's something about the intrinsic qualities of vision itself which trump people's creative pursuits and imagination. Now, I think that's wrong. And I'll illustrate it with something I'm going to call today the light bulb theory of revolution. I'm just, today this is a new, brand new theory, just making it up. But if you've ever been bored, it's actually not a theory, it's jokes. If you've ever been bored and you Google anarchist jokes, you'll have probably come along the same ones that I've come across. And one joke, and this is dealing specifically with those who reject vision, how do anarchists replace a light bulb? How many anarchists does it take to replace a light bulb? None. The light bulb replaces itself. The only thing anarchists can do is help facilitate the process. And what does that mean? If this room were to go pitch black right now, no lights, couldn't see anything, and there's a light bulb in the middle of the room, just beneath the socket, do we just sit there and stare at it and wait for it to replace itself? That's pretty ridiculous. Do we place a ladder next to it and, you know, hope it hops up and hops in the socket? That's ridiculous. Do we hold a flashlight up to the socket so it can see its way? It's all kind of over the top. Granted, this is all tongue-in-cheek, but it does illustrate a tradition of anarchism that does reject vision. Now, the ones that do embrace vision, if they were to try to replace the light bulb, they would have to, unfortunately, undergo critique and criticism that they were authoritarian or vanguardist for wanting to replace the light bulb. Well, for me, I think... You know, we can honestly debate, we can honestly propose, we can honestly share ideas, and but it is more complicated. It's more complicated than, real world is more complicated than theory, real world is more complicated than jokes. Real people have consciousness, light bulbs don't. So people and light bulbs are different. People's consciousness is formed by institutions. And the institutions that they live in, that they operate within, and the institutions that form their society. And we, our consciousness is based on, you know, our previous experience, our hopes for today, and our hopes for tomorrow. Now, one thing, next month, May, is the 40th anniversary of the 1968 Paris Uprising. In 1 month, 10 million people went out to the streets and turned society upside down. And then the following month, lights out. Back to work, back to school, back to the factories, back to the campuses. And and if anybody's familiar with the history of that, you'll quickly stumble upon the posters, the sheep and the statement beneath it, return to normal. Okay, this is not, you know, a unique historical experience where social upheavals have occurred, and then, you know, all of a sudden people are returning to normal. Okay, we want to transcend that normality. We do not want to return to normal. We want to organize and advocate and realize a social transformation once and for all and leave the old world behind. So what is it about, what does it need? What do we require to be able to do this? And I believe we require shared values, shared ideas, shared understanding, shared conceptions and common visions of where we want to go. For me, Malatesta has a quote that I'll paraphrase, and it's kind of the challenge that I think that's presented to us. He says, in the future society, we can't predict when people will wake up. We can't predict where people will go to vacation. And we can't predict when people will cut their nails. However, those people who are concerned with the education of children and the socialization of future generations, they will all meet, discuss, and share their ideas, their ideal institutions, and how they think education and socialization should happen. And then, in the end, people will practice those ideas. They'll experiment with them. They'll try and implement the institutions. And those institutions that best facilitate the process will prevail in the end. I think Pericon and the vision of participatory society is firmly within that tradition. So now there's the question, well, is Pericon consistent with anarchism, or is it another version of market economy? Well, I've just outlined that I do believe it's consistent with anarchism. Is it just another version of a market economy? I'm going to say no. Pericon rejects markets. But first, if you're not already familiar with Pericon, you probably want to know what it is. So I'm just going to spend a few minutes just basically outlining what it is. And Pericon is an economic system. It's a proposal devised by Michael Albert and Robin Hanel. It's been around for, 15, going on 20 years now, I believe. But it's ideas that many institutions are explicitly inspired by anarchism, in various left movements of history, libertarian socialist movements. And it's an economy. And so it's designed to allocate goods and services for production and consumption. It is a classless economy. This means it's a revolutionary economy. And it must exist because we're in that tradition that believes in the totality of oppressions and transcending them. It's in that tradition, it must exist with revolutionary institutions in other spheres of life too. Revolutionary kinship institutions, revolutionary political institutions, revolutionary cultural institutions, revolutionary everything. It has to coexist, otherwise it's going to get rolled back. So what are these institutions and how does it achieve classlessness? Now, I can't go into the other spheres of social life. However, the book that is coming out in May, it does present these things, and it's very relevant to the discussion here. But balanced job complexes. This is something that is very simple to understand, and there's been variants on it in left history and ideology, specifically anarchism. Balanced job complexes are a reorganization of work. Now, going back as far as Bakunin, he critiqued the division of labor whereby work was divided between mental and manual labor. He critiqued that, he was explicit about it, so much so that he critiqued and called into question the oxymoron of the dictatorship of the proletariat, and he went so far as to predict the emergence of a red bureaucracy in the Soviet Union. Okay, in my mind, Bakunin is brilliant. Looking back, he was right about a lot of it, and he was one of the first to foresee this. Balanced job complexes deals with the division between mental and manual labor, but it also deals explicitly with the division of labor based on power and empowerment. So it tries to realize a classless society by looking at who are the order givers and the order takers. Now, traditional Marxist class analysis, Marx himself in 1847 Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, first paragraph says society will be divided along the lines of those who own the property and those who don't. That means those who own the productive assets and those who sell their labor to the employer for mere sustenance and survival. So that is the two-class analysis. Bakunin presented the outline of a three-class analysis. Balanced job complexes is in that tradition of trying to posit a third class of managers and bureaucrats that isn't a sociological manifestation of these workplace relations. It's an outcome that it's a structural institutional role that is equally as important as property relations, equally as important as ownership of productive assets and those who sell their labor. So what it does is it says, okay, yes, the capitalists, those who own the productive assets, are important. The workers who have to sell their labor, they're also important. The managers and those who do conceptual labor in between, who in the Perry-Kahn analysis and framework, they're called the coordinator class, they work beneath the capitalists but above the workers. So a balanced job complex seeks to reorganize the workplace division of labor so empowerment, so everybody has an equal set of both empowering tasks and disempowering tasks. And what's really unique about this is it's not just in one workplace alone, but workplaces throughout society. So the division of labor across society is different from upper and lower class communities. So in this future participatory society, not only will we balance work for desirability and empowerment within a workplace, we also balance across workplaces. So that's one way in which Perry-Kahn is a revolutionary economy that seeks and strives for a classless society. The other way is through a remuneration norm, effort and sacrifice. How am I doing for time?
You want to stop at
4:30. Okay. So the other way Perry-Kahn seeks to attain classlessness is through effort and sacrifice. Now, effort and sacrifice is a little, it's something slightly different than what we're normally used to when conceiving of alternatives to capitalism. Traditionally, the remunerative norm has been from contribution according to need. I would like to look at both aspects of this. From contribution is basically, how much somebody can produce. I mean, if we're picking apples from trees and we're spending hours doing it, somebody might work harder than me just based on the genetic lottery, that they're born with bigger muscles, more stamina, whatever. Or maybe another luck of circumstance is better tools. And then there's the other person picking the other tree, and they each pick apples for 6 hours, and one pile is larger than the other. Well, under capitalism, the remuneration norm is for contribution or bargaining power. But contribution, it's not the norm that we want to strive for in a classless society. It's a norm that produces and reproduces class relations. Remuneration for need, that is something very desirable. That is something that I believe a classless society should want and should strive for. However, it is not the only thing, if we're conceiving between now and tomorrow, now in the future society, we want to have an economy that remunerates fairly. So we want an economy that where when people work hard, they get more. When people, if you want to imagine it like this, if you all run around a race and do laps, the person to win first place is not the person that we want to reward the most. It's the person who achieved their best lap time overall. They could have been last place, but they could have improved their lap time exponentially beyond the person who won first place, and therefore the person last place would have won harder. Now this basically abolishes the genetic lottery and is consistent with a classless society. So Perry-Kahn uses effort and sacrifice as a remuneration norm tempered by need. And the need comes in for where people need it. Elderly, children, sick. It's pretty straightforward. It's not complicated. Now, the other institutional structure of Perry-Kahn that facilitates classlessness is self-managed workers and consumer councils, which are federated throughout society. Now, it's not complicated, but to really, you know, try and walk through every step of the process, it just take more than the time I have left. However, basically, consumer councils propose what it is they want, producer councils propose what it is they want, and there's a little negotiation back and forth. The plans are reworked for a desirable plan that everybody votes on, and that's the plan for the coming year. And it's only commensurate with how much you work. It's not tied down to the last detail of the last second you worked back in January. But it's just a general plan that's flexible throughout the year. Now, the question of whether or not pericon is another form of market economy, I would just like to spend a minute on this, making the distinction between decentralized democratic planning as proposed by the participatory economic model and markets generally. Pericon rejects markets. Pericon rejects the institutional roles of buyer and seller. Because if you're a buyer, you're trying to buy as much as you can for as cheap as you can. If you're a seller, you're trying to sell as little as you can for as much as you can. It's buy cheap, sell dear, fleece each other. If you can, if it's going to help you get what you want, you wrap your hands around the other person's throat until they give it to you at the price you want. This is a generalized pattern through market society. Markets are like poison in a public water supply. One drop in poisons the whole of society. Pericon rejects markets. I reject markets. People who advocate Pericon reject markets. Instead, they want to implement a form of decentralized participatory planning that seeks to internalize the external effects of what would usually go unnoticed in markets. If somebody is smoking a cigarette, of course, that affects people. That's one example. A larger example, if somebody's buying a car and there's a transaction at a car sales place.
About 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll be wrapping up. Then the purchase between the car owner and the car buyer goes there's no input from broader society, but yet the person goes off driving their car around emitting all this horrible waste into the atmosphere. Well, Pericon does away with that. It seeks to internalize the externalities in the model of democratic planning. I just want to quickly wrap up with the last question. I did skip some sections like the values of the participatory economic model. It's very important. I will just say quickly, whatever strain of anarchism you identify with or not, go out, read online the debates, the books, read the counter arguments against, read the arguments in favor of, and decide for yourself. The last question here, the road to Pericon, revolutionary or reform? Well, in fact, there's been some books written in the past. Michael Albert's written explicitly about this question in moving towards a program for a participatory economic system, where he proposes, you know, shortening the work day to 6 hours, shortening the work week, raising taxes on the rich, some basic traditional labor strategies and struggles. Tom Wetzel, when he approaches the topic, he talks about working class struggle and posits it in a very traditional working class wildcat strikes, organizing, this kind of thing. Brian Dominick, he has a chapter in the book that's coming out next month where he not only advocates transforming already existing institutions, but also presents a dual power strategy for alternative institutions and counter institutions. Counter institutions are designed to protect the alternative institutions and to propagandize for the new system we want. And is this it? Of course not. There are all kinds of strategies. If we're against shortening the work week, if we're against increase in wages, then we're basically giving up on the idea of reforms as any plausible solution to moving forward. Now, I think all the strategies that I just presented I'm very crunched for time, so I had to just basically list them off. But basically, the idea behind them all and realizing a new society, a transformative society, would be to pursue these ideas, these strategies, these tactics in such a way that empowers people as they do so and leads to new gains and new victories that further empowers them until we empower enough of the society to take over. And to me, that is a revolutionary strategy for a revolutionary economy and a revolutionary, you know, society. So thanks. I didn't have enough time.
We'll have plenty of time for questions and clarifications.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm Wayne Price, and I'm speaking for, let me say again, that people in the back might want to move up. These microphones do not work for sound, and you're basing yourself on our ability to project. I'm a member of NEFAC, Northeastern Federation of Anarchist Communists. And as was mentioned about the range of different types of anarchists, we are the pro-organizational. We are pro-organizational. We believe in building an anarchist organization, and we believe that at the same time, along with that, building mass organizations of working people and of people who are oppressed. So, and we come out of the anarchist-communist tradition. That's who we are. Not at all similar. We have nothing in common with individualist anarchists. So I guess we would pick up the light bulb and put it in. And I'm glad to have this dialogue, because while we think what we think is true, we are also believing that nobody's got all the answers. Nobody has got the absolute truth, like a Leninist vanguard. No one group in North America, which is a very big place, a very complex place, will have all the answers and all the best militants. So we're happy to work with others and to be in dialogue with other tendencies. And both of us, both of our tendencies come out, as I think made pretty clear by Chris, come out of the councilist tradition. Time and time again, there have been revolutionary upheavals by working people, and time again, they have organized themselves without anybody telling them what to do.
You need to take the microphone.
Huh? Yeah.
This is my mic. Okay,
this is
my mic.
Okay.
We need a third member of the panel. And time again, people have organized themselves into committees with direct, face-to-face democracy. And this is true whether we think of the Paris Commune or the Soviets of 1905 or 1917 in Russia, or the workers' councils and committees and peasant communes organized in Spain in the 30s, or the workers' councils in Hungary in 1956 and elsewhere in the 50s in Eastern Europe. Or if we even think of, I'm skipping around a lot, of Argentina, the Argentine rebellion of a few years ago, where there were neighborhood assemblies throughout the cities, as well as workers occupying the factories. The tendency to recreate face-to-face community that human beings evolved to be with, decentralized communities from the so-called tribal past, and recreated in modern times, modern industry, has been a universal and didn't depend on anybody's theory. Quite the contrary, usually the Leninists or the vanguardists say, just listen to us, we'll tell you what to do. Instead, people form these committees. Now, we agree, in my opinion, because we don't have an official NEFAC position on Paracon, so I'm expressing my personal opinion on this. We agree on certain areas. The basic concept, which actually I wish Chris had gone into somewhat more, about having a planning mechanism that's neither centralized planning nor market market through the market, as in Yugoslavia had it, but is built by, in effect, workers and council of consumers and workers' councils negotiating back and forth through the internet and other means and working out an overall democratic, bottom-up, socialist planning mechanism and developing a plan for all the people. I think that's a pretty good idea. And that we would have something like that. Whether it would be precisely the Parathon Plan is another issue. But I think it's going to be something like that. I like the idea of balanced job complexes. Of reorganizing in a socialist society, we would chop up jobs and reorganize them in a different way to do away with the distinction between leaders and led, organizers and organized, those who give orders and those who obey. And this goes back, you have concepts go back to Kropotkin, they go back to Engels. There's nothing new about that, but it's good to bring it up to date to a modern society. And we agree also that there's a danger in the movement to be dominated by middle-class people, middle-class elements. Although very often the movement of radicalization may start with young students or middle-class people, in order to bring them into the movement in a safe way, they've got to give up middle-class orientation, adopt a working-class orientation. A lot could be said about what that means, but the basic concept that there's a danger in people. I remember being in a meeting of a group of radicals in some forum about something or other, and one of them stood up and says, don't we think someday that we want society is not run by the capitalists, but is run like people like us? No, we don't want a society run by people like us. We want a society run by the working class, by the people of society, well, you know, the working class and the oppressed. So those are things that we agree on. Now the disagreement, I'm also going to say, within this context, my major disagreement, I'm not going to go into the things that people raise about the communism and how people are paid, or other things, but let me put the disagreement this way. It's too stand pat. It's too organized. It's too definitive. This is the Parathon system. Buy it or don't buy it. I tend to think that, again, give you an example of North America or even think of the world. Just too complex, too big. The idea that every region is going to do a socialist society, a free society, the same way doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Precisely because I am a follower of Malatesta. That I can see one area saying, well, we're going to make things as decentralized as possible, and another one saying, we need to serve more of a centralized elements of a plan. And one area saying, we're going to pay everybody immediately, like communism. No one gets any pay at all, and they work as hard as they can, and they get what they need. And someone else saying, oh, try out the payment system, like the Paragon suggests. And somebody else saying, well, we'll have a mixture. We can expand an area of public payment, sort of like Marxist conception. And we'll have another area that's, so you have to get paid. And meanwhile, it's a basic communism of, you know, just to say, we're all protected by, you know, firefighters and we all have the streets and water. As productivity increases, we'll have more, give everybody basic food, clothing, shelter, and so forth. And eventually everything will be covered under this kind of free communism. It's an experimental kind of thing. One people may want to have cities, and another system might, another region say, no, we want to have regular, smaller communes which integrate agriculture and industry in a new kind of way. And one area might say we want to have our society run by workers' councils because we're impressed by the anarcho-syndicalist tradition. And it's the workers' councils that will make the decisions. And another one says, no, we don't believe in workers' councils. We want community councils to make the decisions. And maybe they're impressed by libertarian municipalism or whatever. But what I'm saying, you know, people may decide one area to decide decisions by consensus, and another place may decide decisions by majority, whatever. I think my point is clear. I see an experimental society. This concept is not simply of the Marxists used the concept of a transitional society, but I think not so much as a transition, which sounds like it's going to end, once we get there, but rather a changing society, an experimental society, where people try different things and move in a different way, and you never stop being in a transition to something new. So that's my first criticism. That paradigm seems to be a full-scale, answers everything program instead of a part of a more experimental, looser kind of way of thinking of things. My second point is the reform versus revolution concept. Now, there's a lot of, in my opinion, mistakes about that, what it means, reform and revolution. Being a reformist doesn't mean that you're just for reforms, because everybody's, almost all revolutionaries are also for reforms, as was stated, but for reforms that move, indeed, I like the way of saying it, that move forward, move to a more radical phase and so forth. The real question is this. Do you think that it's possible to move gradually, piece by piece, slowly, peacefully, in from this capitalist society into a socialist society? It's not enough to say, I want a brand new society. I want a totally different society. That does not make you a revolutionary, I'm afraid. What makes you a revolutionary is the belief that, because the historical reformists, the revisionists of Germany, the possibilists of France, the Fabians in Britain, they all wanted a brand new society, but they believed that they could get to one by peaceful, gradual change. And similar, Proudhon was an anarchist, but he believed that he could get to a new society by gradually building up alternate institutions, mutual bank, whatever, and these alternate institutions sort of grow peacefully until they spread over everything in the new society. That's the form anarchist reformism tends to take. We reject that notion. We say that the capitalists and their, with their state will not let us make peaceful change moving into a new society. That the capitalists and their state will say, if it looks, they're not too stupid, or some of them are stupid, but they have intelligent people who work for them. And they will know when they are threatened. And if they start seeing cooperatives taking over the market, they will find ways to smash those cooperatives, pass law. And if you try to make law, pass laws, they will know to stop that too. And if it gets too dangerous, if the reformist movement, see, I read the early writings of Michael Alpert, and he expects a peaceful transformation of society. Yes, he does. I've had it before, I quote it to you. If they felt threatened, they would close down the democracy, the bourgeois democracy. They would cancel elections. They would organize fascist gangs. They would have a coup, organize the police or the military to make coups. And they would attempt to drown the workers in blood. Massacres. And this has happened again and again and again. Just the examples I cited of revolutionary changes, almost every one of those cases was drowned in blood. Because if you don't have firm perspective that you're going to have to go all the way, that you're going to have to fight for it, there will be no peaceful change. It's only when they feel absolutely threatened, there's nothing else they can do, and completely demoralized, would it be possible for change to go through. That's my argument there. Now, given the lack of time, of course, we're doing this very condensed, so to say, Wayne, you're giving, or if you say Chris is, Wayne or Chris is giving things very condensed and simplified, the answer is yes, we are, because we don't have much time to give you an in-depth analysis. My last point is this stuff about the coordinators. Now, it's true, there is a bureaucratic managerial class that serves the capitalists, which is if we made a pile in society behind above the mass of working people and the poor, we would find, say, better off workers, white collar workers and so forth. They're often called part of the middle class, but really they're part of the workers. And above them is the class that he's talking about, the managers, professionals, the better off professionals and so forth. They exist, but they're not an extra class. They're not a class that's separate from capitalism. They exist because the capitalists find them useful. The capitalists choose them, build them up. If it wasn't for the capitalists' need for the managers, there wouldn't be any managers and bureaucrats. Now that doesn't mean there aren't conflicts between the managers, the bureaucrats, and the capitalists. Because the Paracons cite this a lot. They go, well, of course there are conflicts. This is a competitive society in which everybody's in conflict with everybody. And certainly every layer of society is in conflict with every layer of society. Everyone's in competition. But these bureaucrats want to become capitalists. And the upper levels of them do become capitalists. They get paid not just in cash, but they get paid in stocks. They get paid in stock options. They get into, they become part of the capitalist class because they're not an anti-capitalist class. And given the, it's true, under exceptional circumstances, this kind of class can take over and run a society on its own, as they did in the Soviet Union, as they did in China, in Cuba, in North Vietnam, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't have to speculate about that anymore. This layer organized a capitalist society in which the workers bought and the workers sold their labor power, which was bought by these by the bureaucrats, the managers, and they produced commodities, which the workers then go out and buy from the capitalists, that is from the bureaucracy. And the major firms and enterprises inside the system sold goods, whose meaning productions back and forth, and foodstuffs were sold as commodities from the collective farms. That is, it was thoroughly a competitive society, a monopolistic society, a state capitalist society. And as I say, histories have answered the question. See, it's clear that that bureaucracy was not distinct from a capitalist bureaucracy, because we've seen how easy this is, under certain stresses, it slid back into traditional capitalism. Without any violence, without a big upheaval, without a revolution, things that you'd expect if this was really a change, a total change of society, a change of classes. So while I think there's a real problem about the bureaucracy and the management and so forth, the notion that this is a special non-capitalist class that it can run a non-capitalist society, the idea that the Soviet Union was a third kind of society, a new kind of society, neither capitalist and socialist, is really extremely simplistic and shallow. Because it's made without any analysis of how does the system work? What are the forms of conflict inside it? What will lead it forward? What will cause it to fall apart? What are the basic thrusts and conflicts in it? None of these are made clear. It's extremely superficial, and it's done without any analysis or any attempt at reading other people who've written about either state capitalism or even the bureaucratic collectivist theories. So it's a really extremely shallow analysis. All right. Let me wrap up then. This outline-y kind of talk I've been giving. It's not that we have this basic difference in values because we don't. And it isn't that we have a fundamental difference in many of the ideas, because I don't think we do. I do have certain criticisms, but that's part of the dialogue. We are both tendencies in the broader movement who can ally with each other. Things to learn from each other, and have interesting things to say, but we also have certain disagreements that are worth discussing. Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. So let's take questions, and particularly if you have clarifying questions for concepts that weren't entirely clear, I'm really encouraging that. Yeah.
I guess I have a few questions, but I'll limit it to the question of revolution. I guess Chris can clarify this. I think it's a miscategorization to say that all, you know, for example, those who favor a participatory economic system believe that a new economic system beyond capitalism will come about simply through the displacement of the current system through cooperatives or councils, etc. I think that, you know, forms of dual power are necessary, but ultimately, you know, a new economic system is going to come about through open confrontation with the existing order, and I think that many people stand by that. Liebman, Chris, do you...
All I can say is, you know, I think this false dichotomy was set up in that we agree with what Wayne presented about you start making certain advances in structural transformation and the state will react. And the violence of the state is lethal beyond, you know, what we can imagine, and we have history to look at. And I believe a false dichotomy was set up because we agree with what Wayne presented there. And I know, you know, Michael does too, and a lot of people do. So I agree with Wayne's assessment of, you know, what social progress means for elites and their the way they're going to react.
All right. I'm glad we agree. And I didn't mean to say to imply that everybody who believes in Paracon is a reformist. I know Tom, for example, is not a reformist. It's perfectly possible to have the Paracon goal as a goal and believe it has to take place with a revolution that challenges the state, smashes the apparatus. However, I have never read anything by either Michael Albert or Robin Hannell saying they will be ultimately be a confrontation. Hannell has just written a book in which he says explicitly, I believe in reforms, in reformism. And the way to build a society is to have two kinds of reformism, both the alternate structure reformism and the electoral reformism, and that they balance each other out. That's what he says in his last book. And Michael Albert, most of his books, doesn't say a damn thing about it. He never does not explain. I was at a conference with him, Life After Capitalism, I think it was, and he started to describe what will happen after the bump. He called it a bump, the change from capitalist society to the Paracon society. He simply, and his books, moving forward, the others, he never says it has to be a confrontation with the state, and I don't believe that. He may have said it to you personally, but he don't write it down.
Do you want to follow up?
If I could follow up, and I'll try and be brief because I know there's lots of questions and I see hands up. Certainly everybody who might desire this kind of economic system and this kind of, you know, complementary vision for other areas of life have different ideas about how to go about it. Now, I have never personally, and I've read, believe me, I've been following this stuff for a long time. I've never once read anybody who advocates it say will come about by only peaceful transformation. Anybody ignore the backlash of the state. However, there is debate about how to do it. I know, for instance, Wetzel and Hannell disagree. Tom Wetzel and Robin Hannell. But even if you have your own idea about how to get there and your own ideas about reform and revolution and the strategy and taxes and your idea about the state and social movements, that doesn't say very much about whether or not you agree with the vision. So, you know, think, you know, the process of developing, you know, social transformation is going to happen many different ways. There will be resistance by the state. Nobody who advocates this vision would disagree with that. And, you know, it's going to be, you know, a core because of all of us doing this process.
Now, I know you had follow-up questions, but can I call on someone else come back
absolutely.
To you later? The woman in the red t-shirt?
Chris, can you speak to, I don't know what they're called, but the organizations which in the book were posited to replace the IMF and the World Bank and these sort of surrogate groups, because in my admittedly limited understanding of this economic theory, what was posed for the replacements of these groups is in pretty direct conflict with the idea of decentralized planning. And I was wondering how, in terms of where that was reconciled.
Well, those, as far as replacing the international economic institutions, IMF, World Bank, and everything, really, I mean, not a whole lot has gone into developing these ideas. So if you think you have a superficial understanding of it because you haven't read that much, honestly, not much exists on that level. You know, the institutions proposed for international trade are designed to facilitate negotiations between countries. So if you look at like the instances between Venezuela and Cuba, they're bypassing the market. They're not trading oil and doctors at market value. They're trading oil and doctors at social value. And this is what an international institution would seek to do, is facilitate between countries. And there's also the process, you know, a less developed country getting, you know, more of the trade-off inherently from any bargaining, because the it's assumed. I mean, this is pretty far off kind of theory stuff. I recommend You all, like, if you're interested, read about it. Check it out. Because there's no way we can cover it all here. There's no way that I can present it to you in a full, convincing way here. But these, we do have to think about this. We do have to think about the forces of global capital, how to curb it, how to restrain it, and how to, you know, ultimately abolish it in favor of some international democratically planned institutions to facilitate that.
Wayne, do you want to have a follow-up on that?
No.
Okay. Eugene, sorry.
Well, I just have another question about reform.
Could you speak loudly?
It's another question about reform. Reform and revolution, within the idea of character, as I understand it, are seen as two connected things. Now, as revolutionaries, as humanists, we must work for reform. But a lot of us don't think that it has anything to do with revolution. Rather, some of us think that it is contradictory to revolution. We must simply do it so we can survive. The Ferrer schools, Ferrer envisioned that as an education reform that would build new minds, but now the only people who have those schools are very wealthy people. Capitalism is very good at co-opting better ways of doing things into its own framework. Now, not so much, crushing it, but using it for its own ends. Also, Paragon seems to believe a little bit too much in the wisdom of the marketplace, really, to pick the better system. Once we throw our cooperative system in the marketplace, we'll beat the capitalism because people will like it more. If that were the case, PCR would not be debated, But so the question is, so it's basically a three-part thing. One, can you really go from reform to revolution in such a smooth way, rather than doing it as two parallel things for different reasons entirely? And two, do you really think, how can this system win in a marketplace that is controlled by the capitalists and runs on capitalist needs? Isn't this really saying the capitalists have theirs, now let's get ours? No, the capitalists have ours, let's get it.
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, so if I can respond to the last point about Perry Kahn and somehow lending too much credibility to the market. In fact, I would argue that we're very realist about the market. So I mentioned May 68 in Paris, and in fact, one of the things that I think a lot of people who are into Perry Kahn see is the formation of consciousness. And that consciousness, and I talked about this, that consciousness is a product of our social institutions, the history, the present, and what we expect in the future based on social outcomes, what's delivered, our institutional roles in society daily. So we have to overcome that. We are entrenched in market relations, capitalist relations, racist, like all kinds of these institutions of everyday life touch us personally. We are embedded with them, and we have to somehow transcend that. Now, that's not lending too much to the market. That's saying, there's a whole society we have to deal with. The market is one thing, but I think this is very relevant to Argentina, as was mentioned. Financial crisis smashes Argentina. People start taking back the factories. They develop a new consciousness within the factories that they can produce without bosses better than they could with the bosses. But the struggle continues in Argentina. And where do people put the blame that the struggle isn't moving forward? When people returned to normal in May 68, where did they put the blame? Did anybody think about it? There was just like lights on and then lights out. People went back to, and those are the institutions and the consciousness that we have to somehow transcend. I think we have to have, I think we have to have shared understanding of what's wrong. The market is one thing. The institutional roles of buyer and seller and how those might inhibit our workplace relations. If you're in a factory working in Argentina or here in the US, a cooperative here, anywhere, there's institutional pressures. We have to look at how the institutional pressures affect our daily lives and our relations with other workplaces, other people, other institutions throughout society. Those are, I think I'm a realist when it comes to that. I don't think I'm lending too much to anything else. We have a lot to overcome. And I think having a shared language, a shared understanding, and a shared common vision of where to go, helps us assess what's wrong. When things fail, we can have a shared understanding, or at least have a framework in which to approach it, of trying to assess what went wrong, reformulating our goals, our strategy, and going for it again, rather than May 68 over 40 years later, and we're still living in this fucked up world.
Wayne, do you want to follow up?
Yes. I do not believe that reform is contradictory to revolution. I think that's a major mistake. It may seem like we can only do reforms and we don't get anywhere, particularly in a period of a peaceful period of relative prosperity and stability. But we are moving into a very stormy period. Capitalism is showing its rot. It's going to may go up and down. Things may get a little bit better and a lot worse, and a little bit better and a lot worse. But basically, the direction is downward. We're going to be seeing a situation where the winning of reforms gets harder and harder and harder. It is in this course, and how do people get to a revolution? It's in the course of their struggle for change, anything, just for, even for bread. The Russian Revolution began with women going out demanding bread. And this is a consistent of any kind of revolution. They start with people demanding normal things that they need, and it's suddenly discovering this, the system cannot provide it. So reform is not counterposed to revolution. If there are those who, unless one chooses deliberately to make them counterposed, which is what the reformists do.
Money, you can collect money. I can give you all the money in the, like all the money in my pockets in that system. You have more money than me. Okay, that's the virus of the market, you know, being put into. Perry kind of abolishes the market, so it's not just a, you know, this is, and it doesn't have money in that sense. Okay, I mean, I don't, so. Say again? No, see, I don't know if you were here for the first part of the talk, but I distinguish between the institutional roles of, you know, buyer and seller in the market. That's the market, right? In Pericon, there's self-managed, decentralized councils, producer and consumer councils. Now, I've already kind of spelt all this out. And in the issue about money, I mean, there is no paper money as such in Pericon, and I don't want to get in having this public discussion like a something. You know, discussion about a little.
I'm not talking about that.
Right.
I'm talking about greed.
No, so I mean, very, very quickly. You know, people propose what it is they want to produce and consume for the year. After a plan's agreed upon, they vote on it, right? Something's voted in. That's the plan for the coming year. That's not a market. Now, of course, it's flexible over time. It can change, and people work for effort and sacrifice. Now, what you consume is not tied, you know, to your. Yeah, it's not tied to like the can of, you know, of it's tomato, like of macaroni and cheese or something, box of macaroni and cheese at the end of the year. Throughout the year, it's flexible. But these are the kind of, it's just the decentralized democratic planning is the idea here. I mean, here, we don't want to get sucked into like a really fine, you know, how does the credit system work or anything like that? This exists in Pericon. Read about it. I don't want to spend a lot of people's time talking about these little things. I want to talk about general things. But these are, I don't think money is a concern in Pericon as in the way that you might think it is. And I'd invite you to just kind of read over
the model of decentralized participatory planning, the iterations, the self-managed councils, and check it out. You know, maybe you still have the questions, and you can email me afterwards. I'll give you my email.
I'm going to take the next question. We have a number of people on the stack, so is it okay to just hold
no,
that?
No, I'd like to.
Go ahead. All right.
I quickly, I didn't want to get into it, but really, when somebody is paid according to how hard they work or number of hours, and because they work this number of hours, they are paid, that is, having their credit, the ability to then order a certain amount of things, or they put it together with their neighbors, who are each one also paid according to how hard they work. And things are produced, at least the next planning round, to meet this demand, which is based on how hard people have worked. Now, frankly, it seems to me it's Paracon sort of reinvents the labor theory of value and enforces it. But it doesn't bother me, as it does you perhaps, because I am in favor of something like that, and for gradually being overcome by an expanding communist sector as things get more and more productive. After a while, they say, all right, everybody can have food, clothing, and shelter. And we get more productive, everybody can get good food, you know, different varieties and so forth, that it can be, and the different sectors can try out different things. All right, that's all.
So I'm trying to just understand what you mean, because I think it's very important. Institutional change, what is an institution? I'd like you to define that, especially compared and contrasted with an organization. And then I think it has something to do with laws, I'm guessing, but maybe
institution and laws?
Laws being institutions, define parameters and roles. And then I think I just want to hear what you have to say about what an international institution would be as opposed to an international organization. And is that a possible conduit for change?
When I mention institutions, when I use that word, I use it in a very theoretical sense. I look at it as things that the institutional roles and relations. Institutions generate outcomes. So a factory, it has an outcome of factory is an institution. A family is an institution. A church is an institution. The IMF is a world. The IMF and World Bank are institutions. And the reason all these things are institutions because you don't get it.
That's an organization. IMF.
Well, you can call it an organization. That's fine. But the difference, what the thing that's relevant here, the thing that matters, is that there are relationships within the organizations or the institutions. Call it whatever you want. There's relationships, and in these relationships, take a workplace. There's the worker, there's the boss, and there might be the owner.
Roles.
And
are
you saying? I'm sorry. I thought you were saying rules. That's an institutional role. Yes. And in those roles, there are expectations about how you behave. Over time, I think a lot of unsaid. There's not concrete policy and law that people are creating. You must behave this way. There is. You're right. There is. But a lot of it goes in self-implemented, without reading or even knowing about it. We're just taught these things.
Social.
I mean, we're all, you know, in a room full of anarchists, we can all agree on, you know, a lot of this. So. I don't know if there's a whole lot to get into, but this is what I mean by institutions. You know, you go to school, you know, it's an institution.
And there's a particular school which I've been calling organization.
We're not sometimes having cross.
There's the institution of school. Okay, go ahead.
Did you want to respond?
No, definitely not.
Did you have other questions that you wanted to ask? Okay.
The international.
I'm sorry, say again?
The international.
Could you address the international institution?
You just want to know an international institution is, or what it would look
like.
Could
it be a lever for transforming society into more of a
peer-to-peer? I think it would have to be part of, you know, a larger process. I don't think it could happen in and of its own. If you just take an institution, you know, trying to somehow rein in global capitalism, it's supposed to facilitate multinational global capital. I think that institution will probably get pummeled. You'd have to have institutions on the ground, people working, people believing in this transformation to, you know, help facilitate it.
Thank you.
One aspect of this debate is remuneration based on effort, sacrifice, as I said, remuneration based on need. But what I don't understand is how you could separate judging effort from privilege. Privilege affects effort. Someone does. I mean, you know, accumulation of wealth affects everything. I mean, we just had two Harvard students upstairs at the refact table arguing pro-capitalist position, saying that, yeah, I mean, we do more, you know, we do more, we belong on top. It was a crazy thing. All right, and this is tongue-in-cheek, but if I hear another college student say, go read Paragon, I'm going to, like, geek, okay, because communism, anarchism, these systems were based on struggle. These systems were based on a history of struggle, revolution. Illiterate peasants organized themselves in the Spanish Civil War, okay? Naturally. This is there's something that's human about it. It's not something that you have to go read about. You don't need a degree in macroeconomics to fill in all the rest of your questions.
Sorry, are you done? Okay, did you want to respond?
I'm not a Harvard graduate. In fact, I'm a high school dropout. and you know, there's a factory in the former Yugoslavia. I can't pronounce it, but some of you have probably heard about it. It's a pharmaceutical factory, and it recently sponsored a Balkan issue of Z magazine, and it sponsored a section on Pericon. They wanted to know. Yeah, I don't know what they're going to decide or whatever, but they wanted to know. And the reason why is because some of the values, some of the institutions, these aren't Pericon values. Like, I don't want to, you know, nobody's trying to co-opt left anything, anarchist anything, and put it into this model and say, this model owns it or whatever, this is the repackaged version. No. It is a direct lineage. I you know, as I presented today, what I think, there are unique aspects to it that are unique in and of itself. Beyond that, I think it belongs to the history of struggle that you're talking about. It belongs, but I and it goes back to a critique Wayne had earlier about, you know, there being different societies coexisting with different experiments happening. This is where I think institutional forces can creep back in, market forces can creep back in, hierarchical forces can creep back in, power relations can creep back in, unless we're very deliberate and self-conscious about it. Now, we should be, you know, human about it and struggle with others to try and figure out the best way to do things. I mean, that's just the way we need to do it. But part of that is being self-conscious about replicating class structure within our movements. Being clear about the kind of world we want. You know, another anarchist strategic principle, implementing the seeds today of the future society. So I think having a shared, you know, understanding, shared conception, is key, so that we don't replicate these roles and relationships we're trying to transcend.
Yeah, I'd like to just raise an issue that's been covered to some degree, but just ask, so what, in your view, are the most important things that we can be doing, should be doing now and in the immediate future to realize these goals?
Why don't you take a crack at it first?
So this is where I always say, get out the machine guns.
Yeah, not a definitive answer, but I'm just wondering, what are the theoretical differences or common grounds? What can they suggest about strategies here and now that we can go out and begin to organize immediately?
In theory, by participating in every struggle there is. Now, but of course you can't do that, so you have to prioritize. I'm a member of an organization. We believe anarchists who agree with each other should organize together. And we believe they should organize together to both develop their theory and also practice. And should participate in whatever struggles are going on in society, in particular, most particular, the struggles of working people, because there's a great potential power in organized workers, but also in every struggle of oppressed people, women, black people, and so forth. Because we think that these struggles, and the point about the book thing, I'm all for theory. I wrote a book myself, which I urge people to go and buy, and give my point of view on all this. But along with the theory has got to be the practice, the participation in the struggle, to be not just someone sitting down and sucking out of his thumb a particular theory, a vision of a beautiful new society. That can be useful, but essentially it's got to be part of the actual thing what people are doing, what people are engaged in. The idea of councils, as I said, was thrown up by actually working people in the course of things going on, struggling. And you got to be part of that, and at the same time coming back to it with, say, learning from the mass struggles, and at the same time telling people, suggesting to people what you think, what we think as one tendency is a set of ideas, and fighting against those we disagree with. Fascists, Stalinists, social democrats, all those people are going to be around as the next wave of struggle, which is already beginning as it boils up. So there's quite a lot of things to do, in my opinion, but they involve organization and a revolutionary approach.
Chris, you want to follow up? What does Pericon say we do now?
Well, I hate to frame it that way. What does Pericon say we do now? Again, I mean, I think we all have to decide how we're affected in our own lives and what kind of struggle we need to engage in, as well as solidarity struggles, both locally and internationally. But I do think we need to do so consciously, once again, to not replicate class structures, and I'm going to be very clear about class structures with managers and bosses and workers, as well as, you know, class structures in our own grassroots organizing, whatever. But, I mean, there's no single answer. We've doing what we're already doing, but doing it in such a way where we try to deepen our consciousness about what we want, discuss it with others, debate it with others, practice it with others, and constantly move towards complete structural transformation of society, not just capitalism, but everything, the defining institutions of society. And, you know, at some point we will come up against the state, and if our power doesn't surpass their power, they will beat our ass. So we need to create a situation where if they beat our ass, we'll come back twice as strong and beat their ass. And are we there now? No, I think we're a long ways from that. So I wouldn't say go pick up the gun right now or you're going to get your ass whipped, probably. But we need to create conditions where we can take over, eventually.
I'm skeptical of both Pericon and Pericon. It's not like I'm not well versed in either. My main concern, and one of the things that I like about Pericon, is it speaks to recuperation or attempts to. Pericon's a model that's graphical, and it's not graphical by everyone, and that's where there's a problem there. What I sort of started to like. No, but it's that there's a model that's in place that I can put in front of some people that I know. The reason I left animism is that some people I know, not everyone, all right? And it's like, I'm socially libertarian. I'll speak to people regardless, trying to understand where they're at so I can account for any argument that comes about. I don't just hang out with animals, okay? Pericon attempts to create a vision of the world in a different way and attempts to move towards that. Anarchism is a lot harder for many people to grasp upon what it would become. And I think that there's a bit of a root, so I like Pericon. I'm not saying I love it. But it gives us something graspable, and when it comes down to recuperation, I think we need to learn to recuperate from their recuperations and stay in the fight. And I haven't seen a lot as, like, anarcho-communism's gotten a hell of a lot better of it since I was more participating, but I haven't seen a lot of that in a way that affects people's everyday lives in Brooklyn and Queens. I just don't see it. And yeah, a lot of us who are in Brooklyn and Queens are middle class, and I'm not gonna feel any guilt about that. I want a realistic, practical solution and an ability to apply it in daily life. I want applications from anarcho-communists and from people who are into Pericon. And the fact of the matter is that I think that if we draw upon everything and change it as we go, it's a good thing. Is Pericon too set? Probably, is anarcho-communism too set? Maybe not enough. And I think that I'm seeing a consistent reorganization where I can give something that's imaginable and I can give people texts. It's improved a lot in the past 15 years. But that's really what I need, is I need like practical applications in daily life, and not when I go to Lower East Side, not when I go downtown. I need it in Queens, and I need it real, and I need it now. So.
Two succinct replies, because we have to set
ask,
up
the
next.
Well, there is.
I'm sorry?
Want to ask, any other, are there any other questions?
Yes, there are.
Why don't you call?
You don't want to respond?
No.
Did you
want to
respond?
The one thing I did want to respond quickly is I agree with you completely. The thing about Pericon, though, is, I'm having a hard time. I think I'm tired. The ideas are just evaporating from my head as they're coming out of my mouth. Let's just go with another question.
Okay. Welcome to my world.
Yeah. Let me just interrupt for a second. The next panel has requested that we wrap this up because they have to do a setup. So I apologize if we are sort of rushing the end a little bit, but we want to be conscientious for the next group. So please, very succinctly.
Okay. Is there a way to create conditions to overcome the
conditions? Me? Or? Yeah.
So you will be talking about the American society is create conditions for we do something.
You're wondering if I think capitalism reproduces the conditions itself versus we have to do it. I think there's an agency issue there. One is waiting for the system to collapse on its own and provide conditions for people to do it. The other is us going out and organizing people. And I say we don't wait for the system to create conditions itself. We go out and organize.
Wait.
Let me just the last overall statement that I agree that a vision is necessary, or visions, but certainly values are necessary. And I also think when you say that the, you know, reactionary forces, tendencies can creep back in, yeah, you know, socialism or anarchist revolution won't solve all the problems. We'll still have to be working on it. And no one can propose a system that doesn't have danger of things creeping back in and the need to keep on struggling. That's all.
So thank you very much. I'm sorry if we didn't get to your questions, but we need to help you understand.